Good morning, everyone. We are reading in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, and last week we made a start with Canto 5, the Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Weakness. Like the previous canto, this one also has seven sections, and each of them gives a different light on the development, the inner spiritual development of King Aswapati. The first section, we didn't complete it, we only read part of it. Where did we stop? Page 75. Out of the depths.
Page 76.
Yeah, that's what I thought, we were on page 76. And we stopped about the line about life gestating the golden child. That's right, that's where we stopped. So the whole of this section is like a summary of the knowledge that King Aswapati has gained, which was expressed in much, much more detail in Canto 4. That was not part of the narrative of King Aswapati's story. Here, a brief summary of that knowledge which he gained is given in this first section. And at the beginning of the canto, we were told that this knowledge first he had of time-born men. He was the first human being who had this illumination. And last week, Amal told me something very interesting about that. Would you share it, please, Amal, with everybody? Amal.
Amal. He's saying that in the Gita, in the starting, he says that I gave, Shri Krishna says that I gave this knowledge to first the sun god, and he gave it to Manu, and then to the king sages, it's called Rashi, it passed on. And in the Chandogya Upanishad, there is a portion where one rishi is, his son is kind of humbled by a king and he asks him a question and the son is not able to reply. So when the father goes to the king, he asks him, can you tell? So he says that for the first time in the history of the world, I am giving this knowledge to you, because this was only with the kings.
Yes.
So it seems that there was some knowledge which was only, and in the Gita, the word yoga is used in this sense. In
for this culture. Knowledge, yes. Which was entrusted to the king stages.
So
yes. So this, we know that in the Indian tradition, it is the Brahmins who receive and pass on knowledge. But there's also this other insight that the king sages have a knowledge which is not more generally shared. And so here Sri Aurobindo is suggesting that the very Aswapati was the very first of those king sages, and that the knowledge which he is passing on to us is that knowledge, which is perhaps a more dynamic knowledge, one more connected with work in the world, as is Sri Krishna's message in the Gita. And of course, Sri Aurobindo's message. So one aspect of that was that Aswapati, with this new view of the world that he has received, he saw the unshaped thought in soulless forms. We may think that all these are soulless forms, but within them, shaping them, there is the formless thought of the Creator. He knew matter pregnant with spiritual sense. Matter is full of spiritual significance and intention. He saw mind, our limited groping mind, but the principle of mind is daring the study of the unknowable, what we believe to be beyond the reach of mind. In fact, that's the definition of the unknowable. It's not that it can't be known in any way, but it can't be grasped by the mind. And he sees life dare its gestation of the golden child. Life, like matter, is pregnant and is preparing for the birth into form of the golden child, the divine in his embryonic state in the subtle worlds. Life is preparing for that birth into the material world. That's where we stopped. Would you read, Luba, please?
In the light flooding, false bank, blank vacancy, interpreting the universe by soul science, he read from within the text of the without. The riddle grew plain and lost its catch obscure. A larger lustre lit the mighty page. A purpose mingled with the whims of time. A meaning met the stumbling pace of chance, and fate revealed a chain of seeing will. A conscious whiteness filled the old dumb space. In the void he saw, throne omniscient supreme.
Thank you. Aswapati has achieved a state of silent mind. Thought has become blank, empty. And it's the mind has become, the thought has become flooded with higher light, light of consciousness. So that light of higher consciousness enables him to interpret this universe by soul signs. He can see the indications given by the soul here in the material world. He's able to read from within, from the soul point of view, the text of the without, as if this whole universe is a great book full of knowledge. But you have to know the code to be able to read it. When he can do that, when he can read it from within, then the riddle, the paradox, the mystery grew plain. It lost its obscure catch, that thing that prevents you from understanding the riddle. And he sees this mighty page of the universe in a much larger light. He can see that all the things that happen in time, apparently by chance, without much reason, there's a purpose mingling with the whims of time. Chance, we wonder why on earth this or that has to happen. Aurobindo says it's a stumbling pace, it's a step forward, but it might be taken in a strange way. But there's a meaning in all those steps. Fate, the predestination that seems to rule this material universe by the laws of physics and cause and effect, instead of that being just mechanical destiny, fate revealed a chain of seeing will. Every step is willed by a power of vision. And all this that surrounds us, that fills the universe, this dumb space, he sees that it's filled with consciousness, a conscious wideness filled the old dumb space. In that emptiness and nothingness, which seems to be the origin and a larger part of our universe, he saw throned there the omniscience supreme, the supreme all knowledge, which has with knowledge and with intention created all this. The emptiness is filled with that consciousness. So as a result of this new seeing, something, a new will and hope enter King Asvapati's consciousness. Anmol.
A will, a hope, immense, now seized his heart, and to discern the superhuman's form, he raised his eyes to unseen spiritual heights, aspiring to bring down a greater world. The glory he had glimpsed must be his home. A brighter, heavenlier sun must soon illumine this dusk room with its dark internal stare. The infant soul in its small nursery school, mid objects meant for a lesson hardly learned, outgrow its early grammar of intellect and its imitation of earth nature's art, its earthly dialect to God language change, in living symbols study reality and learn the logic of the infinite. The ideal must be nature's common truth, the body illumined with the indwelling God, the heart and mind feel one with all that is, a conscious soul live in a conscious world.
This passage is a very important turning point in the poem. It's as if everything we've read up to now has been a kind of prologue, a preparation. But with this will and this hope that Asvapati now seizes, or that seizes him, this hope immense, this is the moment when he starts on his great quest, which will lead him to explore all the many planes of existence, come face to face with the Supreme Divine Mother, and when she refuses to fulfill this will and hope for him, to dare to ask her to incarnate herself in the world, to bring about the realization of this will and this hope. So what is his will, this immense hope that seized his heart? It makes him look up to discern the superhuman's form, the next step in evolution beyond humanity. He looks up to unseen spiritual heights, and he's aspiring to bring down that greater world, that superhuman world. He feels so strongly that the glory that he has glimpsed through this new knowledge, this must become his home here in our world. Sri Aurobindo says we are living now like Victorian children, perhaps the way that Sri Aurobindo himself lived when he was lodging with Mr. Druitt and his family in Manchester. His brothers went to school, but he didn't go to school. He was taught there in the home, like many, many children at a younger age. No? When they were 11 or 12, they would go to school, but before that, they were taught in the home. and there would be a special room in the home which was set apart for that. So it might be a rather dark and dusky room, especially in Manchester in those times. And there's an internal stair linking that room with the rest of the house. No? And that was also typical of those houses. There was a set of grand stairways for the family and the guests, but there was an internal stair for the servants and the children. So the infant soul is learning there in its small nursery school. That's the stage we are almost all of us at. Infant souls learning in the small nursery school. And in that nursery school room, one of the things that was usually there was a set of objects that would be used for object lessons. They could learn about botany from some dried flowers, perhaps arranged under a bell jar. There might be even an animal in there, a lizard or something, or a stuffed bird, some geological samples, all kinds of objects that were used for teaching the children. But those lessons, he says, were hardly learned. But this infant soul has to outgrow its early grammar of intellect. We start beginning to think in a logical way. Perhaps at school we get some help with that. Another thing that they did was to imitate, to draw. In his essay on national education for the college in Calcutta, Shobindo emphasized the importance of this, of being able to see accurately and to imitate nature's art. These are part of early education. And another part of early education is changing the way that you speak. In Manchester in those days, there was quite a strong dialect that everybody spoke, actually among themselves. But in school, children were taught to speak correct, grammatical, non-dialect language. No? So you have to outgrow its early earthly dialect and learn to speak God's language. And instead of seeing those living symbols of reality around, it has to study the real reality which underlies them, and it has to learn the logic of the infinite, which is quite different from the logic we learn in school. All this, he sees, has to happen, not just for him, for the whole of humanity. The ideal must become nature's common truth, its everyday truth. These human bodies must be illumined, filled with light from the indwelling God, the divine being who's inhabiting it. The heart and mind must learn to feel one with all that is. A conscious soul must live in a conscious world. That's the great progress that lies before us. This is the first time that King Aswapati sees this possibility. Not only possibility, he sees it as an inevitability. It has to happen, and he's going to dedicate his effort to bringing it about.
This 9:30, 91, this dusk room with dark internal stair, maybe is referring to the body and the way to the soul.
Yes, that's right. This is an image for that. Yes. And it's not very brightly lit. There is a connection, but it's not very brightly lit. Yes.
How do you interpret this line in living soul study reality?
Sorry?
In living symbol study reality.
Yes, in the nursery school, there are these objects that are meant for a lesson hardly learned. It's a kind of second-hand knowledge, no? But as we grow, we have to learn to outgrow those object lessons and be able to study in the living symbols that are all around us, full of divine presence. We have to study the reality, the underlying reality, which is holding all this together.
So instead of just seeing things as material objects, you see them as symbols of the spirit.
Yes. Expressions of a living reality, not just products of an unconscious force, unconscious matter.
For me, these objects is more also internal objects.
Sorry?
These objects are more part of the internal space of the soul.
Yes.
Like maybe all the difficulties we are facing, no, and they are elements that are there for helping us to grow. And also on the other description is also like that, you know, for me it's the more the internal, not the external, but the...
Yes, it's outgrowing our present way of seeing things, which it belongs in the infant school of the soul, to a more mature and truer way of seeing.
Yes, but all this, no, to learn the logic of the infinite, for example, is through our inner experiences.
Yes. It's the soul that has to learn. That's what he says. The soul has to learn all this. Grow and gain this inner knowledge.
It's both, I think, internal and external. The object's reality is both internal reality and external reality.
We have to learn to read from within the text of the without. Then we see things completely differently. And he wants that to be so, not just for himself. He wants that for the whole of humanity, for the whole world, this greater world. He's aspiring to bring down a greater world. And this is the change he sees needs to come about.
How else can we evolve and be eternal if we don't view or experience a higher, be a finer,
This higher light has to come into our whole being. It's not just into the mind. It's into the
head. How
is it going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, the aura, how does it work?
Partly it's going to happen through evolution. The world is going to move in this way. That's what we were reading, that nature is driving all this forward. But it can also happen our own individual will can collaborate with that. And that's what's going to happen to King Aswapati. He's aspiring to bring down this greater world, and he's going to dedicate all his life energies to that. That's difficult for us to do and to be so one-pointed like he was, but that's the way to become a king rishi.
When enough people on earth want to know what's the purpose of life, what's it all about, what we're here for,
yes,
then we can get there, right?
I see this as a kind of movement that's happening, or a gradual illumination of the whole Earth consciousness. And I believe there are some cosmologists now who are saying that they feel absolutely sure that all this void and emptiness must be full of consciousness, and the whole universe must be a self-organizing system. I haven't gone into it, I only saw a headline somewhere. That's a very significant sign if thinkers are beginning to think in this direction.
People both with religious and spiritual inclination and material, from both sides they're coming
together. Exactly.
To get it together.
Right. So, shall we go on?
As through a mist absorbing peace is seen, the greatness of the eternal spirit appeared exiled in a fragmented universe, made half semblances of divine things. These now would serve no more his reaper term. The immortal scribe refused the doomed tree. The miser of the scanty bargain made between our littleness and bounded hopes and the compassionate infinitude. His height repelled the lowness of Earth's state. The wideness discontented with its frame, desiring from poor ascent to nature's terms. The harsh contract spurned and the diminished lease.
Thank you. Like seeing the peak of a mountain, most of it hidden in mist, or through mist, the mist opens up and this high peak is seen. Like that, Asvapati sees the greatness of the eternal spirit appearing, the signs of it in this fragmented universe. Here, amid half semblances of diviner things. Everything we see in this universe is a semblance, in a way, of something more divine. But it's only a half semblance. It's not fully revealing. So these half semblances of diviner things, they can no longer satisfy King Asvapati. These now could serve no more his regal turn. He is aiming for empire, for rule, for mastery. And these half semblances are simply not good enough. He feels the pride, the self-respect of the immortal, and that immortal being in him refuses to live in this world of half semblances. Like a miser holds on to his little wealth. He's afraid to give any of it out. He has to hold on to it. So he says, it's as if the soul is like having to live in this material world, like a miser of this scanty bargain made between our human littleness and our limited hopes and the compassionate infinitudes. We read about this bargain, this dark agreement last week. No? So, if that's all that's allowed to us, just what the compassionate infinitudes allow us here within the limits of this material universe, and the soul has to hang on to that little, Asvapati is not going to accept that anymore. His height feels repelled by, pushes away the lowness of Earth's state, this existence in the grip of death and ignorance. The wideness within him feels discontented with this very limited frame. So it resiled from poor assent to nature's terms. Resiled is a legal term. You can resile from a contract. You've entered into a contract, you've signed, and you say, yes, I agree. But at a certain point, you can say, no, I no longer agree. I'm not going to accept this contract anymore. You resile from it. So that's exactly what he does. He's not going to assent any longer to the terms, the limitations, the possibilities that nature gives. He's spurning, he's rejecting this harsh contract, this dark agreement, and this diminished lease, the short, you can lease a house, no, or a plot of land for 99 years. It's too little. The agreement is too little. He's not going to accept it anymore. This earth, the lowness of earth's state. Don?
Only beginnings are accomplished here. Our basis matter seems alone complete, an absolute machine without a soul, or all seems a misfit of half ideas, or resaddled with the vice of earthly form, a hurried, imperfect glimpse of heavenly things, guesses and travesties. Travesties of celestial types. Here, chaos sorts itself into a world, a brief formation drifting in the void. Apings of knowledge, unfinished arcs of power, flamings of beauty into earthly shapes, loves, broken reflexes of unity, swim, fragment mirroring of a floating sun, a packed assemblage of crude tentative lives are pieced into a tessellated whole.
Thank you. In this world, only beginnings are accomplished. Only the matter that is our basis and foundation seems to be complete. Life and mind and higher consciousness is not yet complete. And this base of matter seems like an absolute machine without a soul. That's what it appears like. Or if we're living on another level, then with that, everything is just a lot of half ideas misfitted together, jumbled together. There's no overall harmony or wholeness. We may perhaps get a hurried, imperfect glimpse of heavenly things from time to time here, visiting this imperfect world. But it gets saddled with the vice of earthly form. You put a saddle on the back of a horse, no? Or you saddle somebody with a responsibility that he wishes he didn't have to fulfill. And this saddle consists of this earthly forms, the forms made of matter. And they are like a vice. So this word vice, this has two meanings. Vice is the opposite of virtue. So instead of giving it something beautiful and perfect, we give this imperfect, ill-fitting, false appearance. But a vice is also something that a carpenter or a metal worker uses to hold something tightly in place so that it can't move at all when he's working with it. So perhaps the earthly form is like that. It just holds you tight and the inner consciousness can't move freely. That heavenlier thing can't really express itself saddled with this vice of earthly form. So these forms, these glimpses, perhaps artists have these glimpses, but in order to express themselves, they have to use material forms. And those are only guesses and travesties of celestial types. There is a type, a divine form of these things that they glimpse. But when they get expressed here, it's just an imperfect guess, this glimpse, or a travesty. Travesty is when you really give a very ill-fitting form, inappropriate form to something beautiful. Cartoonists do this kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
Misrepresentation of travesty.
A travesty. Mm-hmm. It's an imitation, but a very, very poor and inaccurate imitation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're distorting a travesty.
Distorting, yes.
By an inappropriate form.
An inappropriate form.
It's like a parody.
It's like a parody, yes.
Imitation.
Yeah, the idea of imitation is there, but it's not a good imitation. It's a really inferior one.
Warped.
Distorting. So that's the best we can do. Here, chaos, total disorder, sorts itself into a world, a kind of cosmos, a kind of harmony. And that world is a brief formation, drifting in the void, in space, in the emptiness. And here, all we can realize are apings of knowledge. To ape something, it's a monkey's imitation of something. They ape you, they imitate you. There's also distorting and travesting. So our knowledge is like that, so imperfect. Power, okay, but that power only can go a little way. These are unfinished arcs. Can't complete the circle. It's not all embracing. We do experience flamings of beauty into earthly shapes. It's surprising how often that happens. And we do experience loves, broken reflexes of unity. Reflex here means reflection in water, swimming. Fragment mirrorings of a floating sun. And there's an image of that pure divine sun of total power and light and reflected in our world on the broken waves of troubled waters, fragment mirrorings. And our lives, he says, a packed assemblage of crude, tentative lives. So these lives are tentative, they're attempts, they're experiments, they're not fulfilled, they're still quite crude, and they're all pressed together, packed together roughly, pieced into a tessellated whole. Tessellated, it comes from the word tessera. It's these little bits of marble or glass that are pieced together to make a picture,
a mosaic. It's called opus tessellatum, square,
yes.
Centimeter, stones composed in figurative forms, mosaics.
Yes.
Like you have opus verticillatum, very small.
So it's like that. Our lives are a rather crude mosaic of roughly cut pieces, packed together somehow. It's not a perfect picture of harmony and beauty.
It's not Ravenna.
Yes.
Now, Ravenna is a very beautiful city in Italy, which uses mosaics to picture many things in history and religion, but very well done.
But even then, when you look, even those most perfect mosaics, sometimes they're a bit wobbly, aren't they?
Is he referring to tassel with a cartel-like sand all mixed up thread?
That's a tassel. This is a tessel, tessellated.
Yeah.
Tessera.
No, that is also a light.
Tessera, right? Cut and form is more square. Yes. In a rectangle. Mm-hmm.
It can mean checkered also in the dictionary.
So that means love is the best reflection of the
heavenly. It is a reflection of a divine sun, but it's broken up. Imperfect reflection of our oneness, true divine oneness.
I thought this word apings is good.
Mm.
Because it's not that the monkeys imitate us, we imitate the monkeys. No. So our knowledge is an imitation of the divine knowledge.
So because of all that, you would read now.
There is no perfect house to dwellers. There are blind, noiseless doors that have no key. Thoughts climb in vain and brings a borrowed light. Cheated by counterfeits, sold to us in life's mart. Our hearts clutch at a forfeited heavenly bliss. There is provender for the mind's
satiety.
There are thrills of the flesh, but not the soul's desire. Here even the highest rapture time can give is a living brew of ungrasped beatitudes.
Beatitudes.
A mutilated statue of ecstasy. A wounded happiness that cannot live. A brief felicity of mind or sense thrown by the world power to her body slave. Or a
simulacrum
of enforced delight.
In the seraglios. Read the next line. In the seraglios of ignorance. So you were really unlucky. You got lots of difficult words. The G is silent. Here there is no perfect answer to our hopes. We're always coming up against blind, voiceless doors that have no key. We get blocked and obstructed, can't move forward. Thought climbs, and it does bring some light, but it's a borrowed light. It's not the true light. We are cheated by counterfeits sold to us in life's mart. In the marketplace of life, we get sold things that we think are genuine and will help us or make us happy or richer, but they're just counterfeits, they're forgeries, they're not the real thing. But we buy them because our hearts are clutching for bliss, for that heavenly bliss which we have lost, which we have given up when our souls agreed to incarnate in the material world. In this world, there is provender for the mind's satiety. Provender is animal food. So you can stuff the mind full of that animal food, but it's not really satisfying. There are thrills of the flesh. That's not what the soul really wants. Maybe we can experience some kind of delight here, but even the highest rapture that time can give is just a mimicry, a copy of ungrasped beatitudes, that bliss that we really want but can't get hold of. It's like a mutilated statue of ecstasy. If you can imagine that bliss being expressed in a statue, but that statue has lost its head and one of its arms. In the first place, it's just an imitation, suggestion, and it's even mutilated. The highest rapture time can give is a wounded happiness that can't live. It's a brief felicity for the mind or for the senses, which the world power nature has just thrown to us, we her body slaves, or it's a simulacrum of enforced delight in the seraglios of ignorance. The seraglio is the harem, the place where the concubines live. And perhaps they live a life of luxury and have beautiful things to wear, and perhaps from time to time the king visits them. But they are not free, so their delight is enforced, whatever delight they experience is enforced. Here we are imprisoned in the seraglio of ignorance, so we can't experience true delight. A simulacrum, something that looks like, but yeah, something that, yeah, a facsimile, something like that. Yeah. You read?
For all we have acquired soon loses worth, and old disvalued credit in time's bank. Imperfections checked, drawn on the inconscient, and inconsequence dogs of every effort made, and chaos waits on every cosmos formed. In each success, the seat of failure lurks. He saw the doubtfulness of all things there, the incertitude of man's proud, confident thought, the transience of the achievements of his force, the thinking being in an unthinking world, an island in the sea of the unknown. He is a smallness trying to be great, an animal with some instincts of a god, his life a story too common to be told, his deeds a number of summing up to naught, his consciousness a torch lit to be quenched, his hope a star above or cradle of and grave, and yet a greater destiny may be his, for the eternal spirit is his truth. He can recreate himself and all around, and fashion new the world in which he lives. He, ignorant, is the knower beyond time. He is the self above nature, above.
Thank you. Is it clear? Anybody would like to ask anything?
And chaos waits on every cosmos form?
Chaos and cosmos are opposites. So chaos is total disorder. Cosmos is when things are ordered and harmonious. So we may create a small cosmos, perhaps, but it's going to dissolve.
So he and he is the human being.
Sorry?
Yes. The he and he is everything is the human being, complete medicine of the human being.
The first he here on line 152, he saw the doubtfulness of all things here. This is Asvapati. He sees the incertitude of man's proud, confident thought and the transience of the achievements of his force. But then after that, he is man. No? Man is a thinking being in an unthinking world. An island, each. Actually, as the poet says, no man is an island, huh? But we feel like islands in the sea, the unknown.
So symbolically, it is a complete description of the human being.
Sorry?
Symbolically.
What?
When it's Asvapati, it is in the name of Asvapati.
Asvapati is seeing what human life is like.
Yes,
what humanity is like. Yes. And he's not satisfied with that.
That's an excellent description.
And yet, a greater destiny may be ours, his, man's. That's what we forget. We see all the littleness and the doubtfulness. But Asvapati is seeing there's not only that side, there's the other side. The eternal spirit is his truth. That's what we saw in the secret knowledge, no? Who are these limited human beings? They are all of them, the Lord himself, accepting to be the traveler on the sea of time. Yes?
The line is, he's a star above the cradle
Yes. Well, sometimes we think that stars represent something to hope for, so a guiding light, no?
Astrology.
But that star, he says, look, how much can a human being do in his lifetime? There's a cradle, he's born, he's not going to last long. So that star may be a guiding light for a brief lifetime, but not for long. Huta tells us that when she came to this line with Mother, she wept. She couldn't stop weeping. She said, all those cradles and all those graves. No. But Mother comforted her. And after all, that star is there. There is that higher destiny. For the eternal spirit is our truth. We can recreate ourselves and all around.
What does it mean?
We can. We don't have to be this death-bound littleness. We can access the spirit within us and become more than what we are now. And we can even reshape the world around us because we ignorant, in fact, we are expressions of the knower beyond time, the one who really knows, who's not limited by time and space. He is the self above nature, above fate. Sri Aurobindo says this is the crucial realization, that we can't really start doing yoga until we know this. Because as human beings, we can do some preparation, but it's only when we can really call in that diviner element in us that we can start to do this, to recreate ourselves and recreate the world around us. Yes, Lorraine.
So far, and it's just this researcher,
Yes. So that's a magnificent achievement of the human mind. No? But perhaps he hasn't caught a glimpse that beyond mind, there's another faculty which can do much more than just this knowing, this imperfect knowing, which can have real power, have real knowledge and real power.
Mother is reading this passage. His story is too common to be told.
Yes.
And she's not reading the last line. Why?
Sorry?
Mother is reading that. His life is a story too common to be told.
To be told. His deeds a number summing up to naught.
This last two lines she's not reading.
She doesn't read this consciousness, a torch lit.
This year.
Oh, these last lines. No, she doesn't read that. You know, it's a question of what can you make a picture of?
Such a powerful line.
Yes. Yes, there are many lines we wish she had made a picture of them. But in the beginning, I don't know how far it went on, the lines were being chosen, the lines to be illustrated were being chosen by Purani. But then he went abroad, and after he came back, he died. So Amal took up the work of choosing the lines. But at a certain point in the poem, perhaps not already here, further on, Mother told Huta, you choose. You choose what you think can be imaged, what you can make a picture of. I don't know quite where that happened. And of course, in the beginning, Mother was making the sketches, the beautiful sketches that we see. But also at a certain point, she stopped doing that and said, Huta, you make the sketches and I'll see them. So if you've seen all that and you've decided that the thing to be done is to become the knower the self above nature, above fate, and that you're determined to change this world, to recreate this world, so it's not this dark nursery school room, no, that it's something else, that the ideal becomes the common truth of earthly nature, and the body gets filled with the light of the indwelling God, and the heart and the mind experience oneness with all that is. What do you have to do to achieve that? And that is what is described in the next sections. We can just read one or two sentences. You'll read, Paula?
His soul retired from all that he had done. Hushed was the futile din of his human toil. Forsaken wheeled the circle of the days. In distance sank the crowded tramp of life. The silence was his sole companion left. Impassive, he lived immune from earthly hopes, a figure in the ineffable witness's shrine, pacing the vast cathedral of his thoughts, under its arches, dim with infinity and heavenward brooding of invisible wings. A call was on him from intangible heights. Indifferent to the little out, he dwelt in the wideness of the eternal's reign. His being now exceeded thinkable space. His boundless thought was neighbor to cosmic sight. A universal light was in his eyes. A golden influx flowed through heart and brain. A force came down into his mortal limbs. A current from eternal seas of bliss, he felt the invasion and the nameless joy. Aware of his occult, omnipotent source, allured by the omniscient ecstasy, a living center of the illimitable, widened to equate with the world's circumference. He turned to his immense spiritual fate.
Thank you. I think we can look at that passage more closely next week, thanks to Sri Aurobindo.